birthday's Little Toe Show. Oh, and hello to you all from the toes too. So you ready for a little wiggle? The Toes and I have been writing down 5 reasons to listen to Toe Day's fantastic Little Toe Show, and here they are. Reason number 1, the Wiggly Gang are back with more from Wiggly Park. Reason number 2, we catch up with our sparky heroine Annie Fidgin in It's Only Annie. Reason number 3, we travel all the way to Africa to see what happened when Akimbo met some baby crocodiles in the next part of Akimbo and the Crocodile Man. Reason number 4, you can hear the strange tale about the princess who was more interested in marrying her toad than any handsome princes. And finally, reason number 5, our classic tale, Black Beauty. What's that to us? Oh, yeah, let's not wait any longer. I quite agree. Let's get on with it.
Are your toes wiggly today?
And first up, it's a trip to Keith Faulkner's Wiggly Park. And today, EW and his friends are at a bit of a loose end. What can they do?
EW the Earthworm, Nifty the Slug, Shelley the French Snail, and Moggy the Caterpillar were all together by the flower pot in the Rose Garden in Wiggly Park.
Well, surely, we ought to do something. We can't just sit around and do nothing.
I like doing nothing, is what I'm best at.
Nifty was stretching and yawning.
I agree with EW. It's very important to keep one's mind and body active. But since no one has any ideas worth carrying out, I will do something useful on my own by having a little snack, said the fat caterpillar.
But what do you want to do, EW? Oh, I don't know, Shelley. It's something, well, you know, something exciting. Some sort of, adventure.
Oh, lummox, that usually means that we end up in trouble, doesn't it?
They were all still thinking about what to do when a buzzing sound interrupted them. It was Buzz, the bee, of course, coming in for a landing on the flower pot.
Hello, you lot, having fun?
No one replied.
Oh, sorry I spoke. What a lot of misery as you look today.
I'm sorry, Buzz. It's just that we're a bit bored, you know. Nothing to do.
I'm not bored.
Bored, you say? Don't know the meaning of the word. Far too busy. Just been over the farm. Busy there, too, you know. Yes, by Jove, you should see all those baby lambs.
EW suddenly perked up.
Lambs? Are there really baby lambs at the farm?
Yes. Hordes of them.
Well, there you are, then.
There I am, what?
Well, we'll all go and see the new lamb. Oh, EW, oh, yes, they are so fluffy and cute.
Shelley loved all baby creatures.
Oh, blimey, fluffy and cute.
But EW had decided, and whether anyone liked it or not, they were going to the farm to see the lambs.
Come on, let's get going.
Oh, it's too tiring.
Come along, Nifty. It is better than just lying around here.
I like lying around here.
But they kept on at Nifty, and eventually they were all off. EW out in the lead, as usual, and Nifty slithering along reluctantly at the back.
I say, let's go a different way for a change, and under the gate and across the school playground.
So off they went, past the bandstand, and under the gate, and into the deserted school playground. They were about halfway across the playground when a bell started ringing.
I say, I wonder what that bell means.
Before anyone could answer, a door in the school building burst open and screaming, laughing children came pouring out into the playground. It was playtime.
Quick, make for the gate. Watch out or we'll all get squished.
Luckily, they all made it to the gate and no one got squished. Once under the gate, they stopped to rest.
Phew! Oh, I say, that was a close one, wasn't it? Ha! What a laugh, eh? Ha!
It may be funny to you, EW, but I am not amused at all.
Anyway, we are all safe. All we have to do now is cross the lane to the farm.
They all looked very carefully both ways and listened to see if they could hear any cars coming.
Okay, nothing in sight. Let's get across.
And EW led them over to the farm.
Right, now, where are these lambs, then?
Before we go looking for lambs, EW, don't you realize we need something to eat after a long journey like that?
Yeah, now that's what I call a jolly good idea.
Nifty was hungry, too.
Now look, you two, did you come here to see the lambs or to eat?
Nifty looked at Moggy, and Moggy looked at Nifty.
Tell that silly worm, Nifty.
Well, if it's all the same to you, EW, I should say to eat. Yeah.
Absolutely. Still, a mere earthworm cannot be expected to understand the finer things of life, like food.
So Nifty and Moggy went off to look for something to eat, and EW and Shelley went looking for the lambs. EW peered through a hedge.
There they are! Oh, look, hundreds of them!
Oh, just look at the way they are jumping around their mothers. Oh, aren't they sweet?
The tiny lambs were jumping and running in the field. They stayed watching for a long time until they thought it was about time to be getting home.
No sign of Nifty and Moggy. It's typical, isn't it? Probably still eating. Ta!
Well, we had better look for them and tell them that it is time to go home now.
Shelley and EW searched. But there was no sign of Nifty and Moggy anywhere, and it was starting to get dark.
Shelley, we can't go on searching all night.
But what if something horrible has happened to them?
Well, it would jolly well serve them right for being so greedy.
Eventually, they decided to give up, and so they made their way wearily back to the rose garden.
Lummox, where have you two been?
Said Nifty as he saw them approaching.
What do you mean, where have we been? We've been jolly well looking for you and Moggy half the night. That's where we've been. The point is, where have you been?
Well, that's a silly question, EW. We've been back here for ages, lying around and doing nothing.
Yes, it's so important, you know, after a large meal, to lie around and do nothing. Don't you agree, EW? Ha, ha, ha.
Oh dear, I bet EW and Shelley were a bit cross after all that. There'll be more from Wiggly Park again tomorrow. Wiggly Park was written by Keith Faulkner and read by Andrew Sachs. What's that to us? Oh, you wonder what Annie Fidgen's up to? So do I. So let's pay her a visit right now and find out. I think she's doing something with robots. The story, It's Only Annie, is written by Tony and Jan Payne.
Every year our school asks us to do a project with our family. They usually copy the ideas from a TV programme. This year they wanted us to make a robot. It sounded fun, but no way could my family make one. Miss Felton said, "Not all families will want to take part, but we can all share in the excitement when the families battle it out for best robot prize." "It won't be our family that wins it," I said to Graham. "There's only you who knows about making things, and you're old, and Mum isn't around, and Dad's useless with machines." Graham glared at me. "Old am I? You don't know much, Annie Fidgen, and you don't know much about your father. You don't even know what his job is." "He hasn't got a job," I replied. "He grows carrots and plays with his computer. The end." Gran doesn't get angry very often, but she was now. "Fat lot you know then, young lady," she shouted. "Listen to me. Playing with computers is his job. Your dad is very clever. He might not be able to put up a deck chair or use a hoover, but he knows everything there is to know about computers." "Dad? My dad?" "Yes, your dad. He invents things. If anyone can design a robot, he can. And as old as I am, I can build it." She puffed herself up. "I can take a double-decker bus to bits with a sack over my head." "You can't. I learnt in the army." Gran surprises me sometimes with the things she's done. "You were in the army?" I asked. "Before I became an actress, yes." "You were an actress? See, you don't know anything about anything. I rang Jessica Jolly. Did you get an instruction sheet about the robots? Sure, she said, didn't you? No, I thought my family would be useless, so I didn't take one. What did it say? Why should I tell you? She said nastily. I don't want your robot to be as good as mine. Don't tell me then. Anyway, there weren't many rules. Your robot can do anything. What does that mean? I interrupted. That it can use any kind of weapon. You know, what weapons can we give the robots? Chainsaws, flamethrowers. There was a long pause. Oh, yes. Flamethrowers, she said. Like in Robot Wars. Well, it didn't say you couldn't use flamethrowers. Or axes. Or a machine gun. You could use a machine gun. You're just being stupid, I said. Dad asked me what sort of robot I wanted him to design, and I told him I wanted something really evil-looking with a spike at the front to stab the enemy robots and tip them upside down, a huge hammer to smash them to bits, and a circular saw to slice them up and... Whoa, hold on, Dad said. Are you sure I shouldn't be designing something that sharpens pencils for you or plays hopscotch? I want a cruncher, Dad, like you see on TV. We used bits of junk from Gran's garage to make the robot. When Dad had finished on the computer, I took the plans to Gran. She put on a huge welding helmet and heavy motorcycling gloves. Then there were lots of sparks and Gran was lit up from underneath, like she was in a horror film. She welded bits of washing machine to bits of caravan and added a bike chain to something off a fridge and wheels. She put on the battle hammer and the spikes and some snapping teeth and a long arm with two elbows. It looked a bit like a crab and a bit like a rhinoceros on wheels. Then she tried everything out by touching different wires to the battery. The robot spun around and snapped its mouth. That'll do, she said. Then it was Dad's turn again and he put in the brains. When everything was finished, we tried it out in Gran's garden. It was awesome. Mr. Kravitz's fence was turned into matchsticks and there wasn't a flower pot or a garden gnome left in one piece. I hadn't done anything yet, but now I sprayed on red and yellow flames with car paint and painted the pointed teeth and four red staring eyes. Scary. I couldn't wait for the big battle. When the day came, we went to school on Grumbler, Gran's motorbike. I had to sit next to the robot on top of tools and stuff. Loudspeakers crackled and a voice said, 15 minutes! Billy Williams' family was near. His daddy's a cook. Dad called me over to them and pointed down. On the ground was a shoebox on wheels, and it had an arm waving around with a fork on the end of it and a sausage. I laughed. That wouldn't last 10 seconds in the ring. Dad went over to the next team and pointed again. They had a robot that bumbled about and when it hit someone's legs it turned and went in another direction. Dad, I said, these are pathetic. We'll slaughter them. Dad didn't say anything. He just pointed to a huge banner covering half the school. Glendale Primary School Domestic Robot Competition. What? Domestic robot, Annie. Yes, I agreed. The Glendale Primary School Domestic Robot Competition. Then I thought about it. What does domestic mean? Gran said, stupid girl, it means jobs around the house like cleaning and tidying. We can't put our robot in the ring now. It'll exterminate them. 10 minutes, said the loudspeakers. You have to fix it then, Gran, I wailed. Change it into a domestic cleaning up and tidying robot. Please, Gran, you've got to. Dad said, there's no time, Annie. They'll be starting soon. What do you think, Gran? Gran said doubtfully, I could get rid of the spike and hammer and make it look a bit less fierce. And I could program it in to do cleaning movements. All right, let's see what we can do. But really, I need more time. I went to ask the woman with the clock for a few more minutes. But when I went in her little tent, she was looking the other way. So I just moved the hands of her clock back a bit and waltzed out again, whistling. Ten minutes later, the speaker said, 12 minutes, in a puzzled voice. Then, who do you think I saw? Mum! I yelled and ran towards her. Mum turned and smiled. She was in a crowd of people wanting her autograph, as usual, because she's, you know, famous. But she rushed over and gave me a big hug. I thought I'd surprise you, Anakins, she said. I'm sorry I always miss your special days, but I'm here now and dying to see your robot. Yes, well, where are Dad and Gran? The crowd was still trying to get Mum's attention, but over their heads you could see Gran's welder like a giant sparkler and hear some really loud grinding, banging and drilling noises. Over there, I nodded. 5 minutes. I'd better take my seat, Mum said. I'll see you later. The whole crowd moved off with her. I'd almost forgotten Mum was the famous adventurer. I mean, she's just Busy Lizzie, my mum. A bit of the playground had a little wall around it. That's where everyone was going. Miss Felton ticked off names in a notebook as the teams put their robots in the ring. Jessica Jolly put in a really droopy-looking robot. It was pink, with clothes painted on and sunglasses. One arm had a feather duster and another had a mop. She grinned at me and pointed to the word domestic on the wall. She'd known what it meant. She'd read the instructions. Did you find a machine gun? She asked sweetly. And what is your robot called, Jessica? Asked the teacher. Mrs. Mop, Miss Felton. Huh, pathetic name too. Miss Felton wrote it down, and just as the last team put their robot into the ring and went away, Dad and Gran rushed over as if they'd run 100 miles. Can we borrow a dustbin? Dad asked, out of puff. I suppose so. Why has your robot got sharp teeth and red eyes, Mr. Fidgin? Miss Felton asked. It's to frighten the dirt, Gran said quickly. Our machine is very hard on dirt. It is a domestic robot, isn't it? I mean, it looks like one of those battle robots on television. Course it's domestic, snapped Gran. It's got a broom. It had as well a big playground broom where the sledgehammer had been, and a shovel. It was 4 times the size of any other robot, but Gran had tied a pinny around it to make it look pretty. It didn't, though. It looked angry. Gran went off to find the dustbin. It just cleans up things, I told Miss Felton. It's very domestic. Does it have a name, Annie? Yes, it's called... Oh, no, I couldn't tell her it was called Crusher. I thought of Jessica Jolly's Mrs. Mop. Robo-mop, I said. OK, then, Miss Felton said. Put it in the ring with the others. Most of the others looked like toy robots, like you buy in shops, with extra bits stuck on. One was a little blue fluffy bunny that banged 2 tins together. Nobody had invented anything, or gone to any trouble. Not like we had. Miss Felton blew a whistle. I switched on Robo-mop and jumped out. Dad looked worried. Our robot started racing around like a mad thing, banging its broom and shovel together and roaring like a lion. Sorry, Dad whispered. I didn't have time to change everything. It still thinks it's the Terminator. Some of the robots were hardly moving. Thomas Flem's robot, Jenny the housemaid, was turning slowly in circles, waving a feather duster in the air. Roy Pawson's radio-controlled truck had a scrubbing brush taped underneath it, and he was using a remote control to make it go backwards and forwards. But nobody was looking at them. They were all looking at Robo-mop. It had stopped racing around now and had backed up against the wall. But it was still bashing its broom and shovel together and bouncing around on its springs like it couldn't wait to start cleaning up. Suddenly it leapt forward, turning around like it was wondering where to start. Mrs. Mop made a big mistake and tried to dust it. Robo-mop whacked Mrs. Mop so hard with the broom it made a dent in the playground. The broom must have still thought it was a hammer. Hey, that's not fair, Jessica Jolly yelled. I smiled, but only on the inside. Well, there was nothing I could do. It wasn't my fault. I only painted it. Robo-mop went completely crazy then, bashing robots left and right with its broom like it was swatting flies and flipping them upside down. Then one at a time it scooped them up on the shovel, lifted the lid of the dustbin and tipped them in. And when the last one had gone into the bin, Robo-mop slammed the lid back on, calmly moved to the centre of the ring and switched itself off. Nobody made a sound. They were all too dazed to move, staring at Robo-mop with their mouths open. There, I said to myself, it does clean up. Miss Felton didn't want to give me the prize, I could tell. But I always win, don't I? And who else could she give it to? My robot was the only one left. Gran was pleased with herself, dancing around and punching the air. But Dad went to all the other families, offering to mend their robots. I think most of them had enjoyed themselves, really. Except Mrs. Jolly, Jessica's mum, who found she was allergic to robots. And Jessica Jolly didn't speak to me for a week. Good. It's Only Annie was written by Tony and Jan Payne and read by Katie Walker. And you can catch the next episode at around the same time tomorrow on Little Toe.
Little Toe, Little Toe, I love Little Toe. It's on every day at 7 and back again at 3. That means stories for breakfast and stories for tea.
Little Toe.
Coming up soon, we've got The Enchanted Toad by Judy Corbalis, and our last story of the day, Black Beauty, can be heard in about 25 minutes. Now, though, let's go over to Africa for our new story, Akimbo and the Crocodile Man, written by Alexander McCall Smith. John, the crocodile expert, has taken Akimbo on a trip to see some baby crocodiles in a river in the nature park where Akimbo lives. John is tagging the baby crocs so that he can keep a track of them for his research.
As John performed his work, two of the men kept watch at the end of the sandbank. "The mother will be around here somewhere," John said. "But she probably won't dare come out. There are rather too many of us for her." When all the baby crocodiles had been tagged, John, who had counted each one, made an entry in a book and gathered up his equipment. It was now time to go, to pack up the tent and leave the crocodiles in peace, at least for the time being. "We can come back tomorrow," John said to Akimbo. "If we look very carefully, we might be able to spot these youngsters around at the edge of the river. Would you like that?" Akimbo said that he would. It had been a most extraordinary sight, seeing the tiny crocodiles emerging into the world, and he hoped with all his heart that they would be alive the next day. John had explained to him that there were all sorts of dangers to be faced by crocodiles in their first few days. They could even be eaten by large birds, he said. A heron could pick up and swallow a newly hatched crocodile just as it would swallow a fish. "Their mother would be able to protect them some of the time," he went on. "Do you know that she shelters her young inside her jaws for the first few days?" Akimbo found it hard to imagine. If he were looking for shelter, he thought that the inside of a crocodile's mouth would be the very last place he would try. They returned to the river the next day without any of the men from the ranger station. "It would be better for them to go alone," said John, as the presence of more people just meant more disturbance and less chance of seeing crocodiles. Besides, John planned to launch his inflatable boat on the river, and this really only had room for two. Akimbo was excited at the prospect of going in the boat, and he was even more thrilled when John said he could start off rowing it. "Take it gently," said John. "We're in no hurry, and the last thing we want to do is land up in the water." They eased the small boat into the river, and then, while John held the bow, Akimbo waded out as deep as his knees and climbed aboard. John followed him and then pushed away from the shore with one of the metal oars. Soon, the gentle current of the river had picked them up and began to carry them downstream. Akimbo found rowing harder than he had imagined, but soon mastered it and had them moving slowly upriver against the current. They stayed out in the middle, well away from any rocks or shallows, and watched the reed banks move slowly past. By the time they were nearing the sandbank, where the hatching had taken place, Akimbo's arms were tired of rowing, and he willingly handed the oars over to John. John dipped the blaze into the water so gently that there was hardly a ripple. He was watching the edge of the water intently now, and suddenly he gestured sharply to Akimbo. "That's them," he whispered, pointing towards a reedy part of the bank. Akimbo stared at the water's edge, but could see nothing. Then he noticed a little movement, and then another. In the meantime, John had turned the boat and was slowly approaching the edge. As the boat drifted into the reeds, he handed the paddle to Akimbo. And then, without warning, his hand darted out and plucked a glistening little crocodile out of the water. He held the little creature out towards Akimbo and pointed to its tail. There was the tag, still in position, identifying it as one of theirs. "He's made it to his second day," John said, laughing, as he dropped the tiny crocodile back into the water. "Good luck." They found three more shortly after that, and then John took the paddle again and propelled the boat out into the middle of the river. Then they made their way further upstream, traveling quietly, as John hoped to see other crocodiles on sandbanks further up. But the riverbank seemed deserted for the time being, although Akimbo knew well that this did not mean there were no crocodiles about. They had negotiated several bends in the river when they came across the island. It was at a point where the river broadened out considerably and was fairly shallow in parts. The island was not big, but supported a fair amount of vegetation, including a clump of tall, heavy-leafed trees. John was delighted to have found it, and quickly paddled the boat over to a muddy beach about halfway along one side. They beached the boat and got out to explore. John wanted to see if there were any sandy places which might be used by crocodiles for hatching. Akimbo wanted to walk from one end to the other just to see what it was like. "Be careful of snakes," John warned as Akimbo made his way up to the ridge that ran through the middle of the island. "Have a look around and then come back here." Akimbo climbed up to the top of the ridge and looked down. John had left the boat on the muddy beach and was making his way through the reeds looking for signs of crocodiles. Akimbo turned away and began his exploration of the island. There was not much to see, though. There were no animals, although he thought he saw monkeys in a tree at one point, and there were no interesting rocks or caves. All in all, he thought, as he reached the tip of the island and turned back, "It's a boring place." It was then that he heard the cry. It was a shout, a yell, and it came from the other end of the island. Akimbo stopped in his tracks and listened, but all he heard was the screeching of cicadas and the sound of calling birds. Then there was another cry, and this time Akimbo knew. Running wildly, blindly, his heart pumping fear into his limbs, Akimbo crashed through the undergrowth. It took him only a few minutes, and he was there, at the point of the ridge from which he had set out. And there below him, he saw John, half in the water and half out, struggling and calling out in a mass of foaming water. Akimbo jumped, half fell down the ridge, and reached out to grab his friend. He knew what was happening, but had little idea how to help. "The paddle!" shouted John. "Get the paddle!" Akimbo spun round and reached for the paddle, which lay beside the boat. In an instant, he noticed that the boat had been ripped and was now a deflated piece of limp rubber. Akimbo seized the paddle, raised it in the air, and brought it down with all his strength on a twisting dark shape that seemed to have attached itself to John's leg. There was a dull thud and the shock of contact. Akimbo raised the paddle once more and brought it down again with all his force. At the second blow, the dark shape seemed to lurch backward, and then, in a froth of foam and churning water, was gone. The river calmed, and Akimbo saw John stagger out of the shallows where he had been struggling with his attacker. Safely back on the mud bank, he slumped backwards and pulled himself the last few inches out of the water. Akimbo knelt beside his friend. He looked at his leg and saw that it had been terribly bitten. Bright red blood streaked down, straining the mud beside the injured limb. Without hesitation, Akimbo slipped off his shirt and bound it quickly round the wound, making it as tight as he could in an effort to staunch the flow of blood. The bandage seemed to be having its effect, and the flow of blood slowed down to a trickle. John tried to stand, but the injured leg would not support him, and he fell back against the mud.
It's no use, he said. I think it bond's broken.
Akimbo glanced at the boat, and John shook his head sadly.
He attacked me just as I was trying to launch it, he said. I was going to come round to the other end to pick you up there. He got me as I pulled it out.
Akimbo looked at John's wounded leg again. He would have to get help soon, as the bleeding had not stopped altogether, and there was a limit to the amount of blood that could be lost. And yet, with the boat destroyed, there seemed to be no way of getting that help. Could they just wait it out? How long would it be before a search party found them? It could be a day or two, or even more. And if it took that long, would John survive his terrible injury which the crocodile had inflicted on him? Akimbo thought not. He would have to go for help himself. There was no other way. I'll swim across, said Akimbo. John shook his head.
You can't go into that water, he said firmly. You wouldn't make it. There are too many crocodiles around here.
I could swim quickly, said Akimbo. I'm a strong swimmer. John raised his voice, half in pain, half to show Akimbo that he meant it when he told him not to do it.
No, he said. You can't. You wouldn't make it.
Akimbo looked out at the river. Perhaps there was a place where it was shallow enough to wade across. Perhaps there was a place with stones. But the river, although not always deep, was not that shallow. The only way of crossing was to swim. Or, Akimbo smiled. Yes, he had remembered the fallen branch which he had seen just a little way up the ridge. He had had to step over it, and he had thought how it could well have made a dugout canoe. He turned to John and explained his plan enthusiastically. He could roll the branch down to the bank and launch it from there. It might not be the perfect boat, but at least it would float. The paddle had survived the encounter with the crocodile, and he could use that to propel the log across to the other side. John seemed doubtful.
You're still going to have your legs in the water, and the log might not be so easy to steer. You could find yourself floating downstream for hours.
It's not that big, argued Akimbo.
I'm sure I'll manage.
He looked at John's injured leg. Blood was still seeping through the bandage.
I've got to get help, Akimbo said. There's no other way.
John gave a wince of pain. He knew that Akimbo was right, and so at last he nodded his reluctant agreement to the plan.
The crocodile attack sounds like a frightening experience. I don't know how Akimbo can be so brave. Find out if Akimbo can float to safety and raise the alarm tomorrow in Akimbo and the Crocodile Man, written by Alexander McCall Smith and read for us by Maynard Ezeashi.
Listen out for a Wiggly Show. It's on twice a day. Call Little Toe.
Little Toe.
Our next story now is called The Enchanted Toad and is written by Judy Corbalis. It's about a princess who's more interested in marrying her toad than a handsome prince, despite her father's plans. But, as you'll find out, the toad gives both of them an unexpected surprise.
There was once a king who had a daughter called Princess Griselda. Griselda, he said to her one day, I have a serious problem to discuss with you. What is it, Papa? Said the princess. I think, said the king, it's time you were married. But I don't want to be married, Papa. Sooner or later you'll have to be, said the king. Why not now? I don't know if I ever want to be married, Papa. What nonsense, cried the king. Everyone wants to be married. Why, I was married at 20 and your mother was married at 15. I know, Papa, said the princess. And when she was 18 she went off to race cars and we haven't seen her since. Griselda, said the king, you are not to talk about Mama. You know it only upsets me, and I want you... In fact, I'm ordering you to start thinking about who you want to marry, because if you don't come up with some good suggestions yourself, I shall have to choose for you. And he stamped out of the royal drawing room. At dinner, the king asked Griselda if she had decided on a husband yet. "You only asked me to think about it 5 hours ago, Papa," said the princess. The king banged his fist on the table. 5 hours is long enough for anyone," he shouted. "Not for me, Papa," said the princess calmly. "And if you bang the table like that, you'll spill your soup." "Oh, be quiet," roared the king, and he slammed out of the royal dining room. The princess ate the rest of her dinner in thoughtful silence. Next day, she had breakfast in her room, got dressed in her best golden dress, then slipped outdoors. "Your Highness," said the court usher, as she passed him on the stairs, "have you remembered His Majesty has asked several neighbouring kings and queens to lunch today? He particularly wants you to be present." The princess nodded. "He thinks he'll be able to marry me off to one of their sons," she thought, and she carried on downstairs even faster. She stayed in the gardens for an hour or two, then crept back upstairs to her bedroom unnoticed. A little later there was a blast of trumpets. Princess Griselda picked up something in her hand and set off downstairs. "And this is my daughter Griselda," said the king as she came in. "As she is my only child, she will eventually inherit the kingdom, and I really feel it's time she was married." The royal guests smiled at the princess. She smiled back. Then, taking a deep breath, she said, "Papa, I've found a husband for myself." The king was curious. "Let him come in," he said, "so we can all see this mysterious fellow." The princess went out to the hallway, picked up a small box she had deposited there, and carried it in. "Well," said the king, "where is he then?" The princess lifted the lid of the box. "Here, Papa." The king looked in the box. "That's a toad." "Yes, I know, Papa," said the princess. "I've fallen in love with it, and I'm going to marry it." "Griselda," thundered the king. "Lunch is served, sire," announced the footman, appearing at the door. One of the visiting kings leaned over and whispered in the king's ear, "I shouldn't discourage her too much if I were you. It will almost certainly be a prince under enchantment." So the princess took her toad in to lunch, and it sat by her golden plate as she fed it tiny scraps of her own food. The visitors left in the early afternoon. Griselda shook hands with them all and smiled. The toad stared at them with unblinking eyes. The king felt a light touch on his shoulder. "Don't forget, get the enchanter in right away," murmured his friend. The princess took her toad into the library. She was just examining its warts when a herald arrived with a message that she and the toad were wanted in the throne room. The princess was impressed. "Something special must be happening," she said. "I wonder what it can be." The throne room door was opened by the court jester. Inside the room, in full regalia, were the king, the Lord Chamberlain, the chief judge, and the court enchanter. Griselda went into the room. "Good afternoon, my dear," said the king. "The reason I've brought you here is because I happen to believe your toad, that is, my son-in-law-to-be, is really a prince under enchantment." The princess was very disappointed. "Oh, Papa, I hope not." "Don't be ridiculous," said the king. "Now bring that toad over here and put him on the small table." Griselda put her toad down in front of the enchanter. The enchanter looked at her with piercing green eyes. "Stand back, Your Highness," he said. Then, taking a huge red silk handkerchief from one pocket of his robe and a wand from another, he dropped the handkerchief over the toad, threw a powder from another pocket over the handkerchief, waved his wand over it, and muttered strangely to himself. There was a sudden flash of pink smoke and a dull boom. The toad disappeared, and in its place stood a white rabbit. The princess was overjoyed. "How wonderful! I've always wanted a rabbit." "Not for a husband," roared the king. And to the enchanter he said nastily, "You'll have to do something considerably better than that." From behind the throne, the enchanter took out a large book, which Griselda was sure had never been there before. He studied it intently, then reached behind the king's ear and pulled out a large lemon. "Oh, dear," he said, and reaching behind the king's other ear, pulled out an enormous black spider. "Stop that at once," commanded the king, "and get on with the job." The enchanter plucked a star from the air above his head, laid it on the blue handkerchief, twirled three times on his toes and shouted, "Abracadabra!" There was a blinding flash of green light and a beautiful red sports car appeared before them. The king looked very hard at the enchanter. "I see, a sports car." "Well, yes," said the enchanter. "I told your majesty these things take time." "Look," said the king through clenched teeth, "I cannot have a sports car as a son-in-law. The princess cannot marry a sports car." His voice rose. "Who ever heard of a kingdom ruled by a sports car?" The enchanter took out a checked tablecloth from the back pocket of his robe and flung it over the sports car, lifted three lizards out of one of the banqueting dishes and laid them on the cloth. Then took a vial of red liquid from his sleeve, shook it over the lizards, and waved his wand over them. A tongue of flame shot in the air. Everyone screamed and jumped back. The smoke cleared, and there before them lay a fish finger. "No, no, 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 no," screamed the king. "There is no such thing as a kingdom ruled by a fish finger. I'm not having a fish finger as a son-in-law. I'd rather have a toad. Take him away," he ordered, pointing at the enchanter. "Off with his head and bring it to me on a plate. It'll be a pleasure, I can tell you." The Princess Griselda jumped to her feet and stood in front of her father. "I won't have it, Papa," she cried. "Of course you're not going to chop off the enchanter's head." "It was just a temporary setback, sire," said the enchanter. "I've prepared my next and final spell now." "You'd better get it right this time," snorted the king. "I will," said the enchanter. He drew a purple silk cloth with golden stars on it from the chief judge's trouser leg and laid it over the fish finger. Then he reached inside his own mouth, pulled out a tonsil, and laid it on the cloth. "Ugh," said the king. "How disgusting!" "But effective, sire," replied the enchanter. "And now, please, absolute silence." He knelt down, crossed his fingers, his toes, and his eyes, and breathed on the tonsil. The tonsil quivered and grew and grew. The purple cloth with golden stars rose and shook until it seemed to fill the room. There was a boom of thunder, and light like the sun dazzled them all. Suddenly there was a jolt and a bang, and they all flew up to the ceiling and fell to the ground again. The room grew dark. "Nearly there," said the enchanter's voice through the gloom. A misty cloud was gathering in the middle of the room. A dim human shape began to form inside it. The enchanter sighed with relief. The king muttered, "About time, too." And the princess said to herself, "I hope this prince likes having fun." The cloud began to dispel. The light slowly returned to normal, and the figure emerged more clearly until it stood visible to them all. "Good Lord," cried the king. "It's Marguerite." "Hello, darling," said the figure. "Mother," shouted Griselda, and threw herself into the figure's arms. "And where have you been for the past 11 years, then?" said the king. "Oh, Arthur," said the queen, "don't go on and on. I thought you'd be so pleased to see me. I've been away seeking my fortune, of course. I'm an extremely famous racing driver." "Well, I've never seen your name, and I've checked all the Grand Prix racing lists," said the king. The queen was touched. "That is romantic of you," she said. The king blushed. The queen hugged Griselda tightly. "It's so wonderful to see you at last, my darling. I've wanted and wanted to come back, but I couldn't until I'd proved myself by becoming a champion. And I've finally done it." The princess clung hard to her mother's neck. "I'm so glad you're back, Mama," she said. "What I don't understand," said the king, "is if you've reached the peak of your career, what on earth were you doing in the palace gardens disguised as a toad?" "I didn't do it on purpose," said the queen. "I was racing better than anyone, and it was clear I was going to be the winner. And one of the other competitors, who'd been a wizard until he gave it up for racing, was so jealous that after I'd won, he cast a spell over me and changed me into a toad. It took me 7 months to hop back here to the palace, and it wasn't till this morning, when Griselda found me, that anyone noticed me. And, of course, you know the rest of the story." "Well, if everyone is happy now," put in the enchanter, "I'd quite like to be getting off home to my own family." "You've done marvellously," said the queen. "I shall personally reward you." The enchanter smiled. "I still don't know how I'm going to get Griselda a husband, though," muttered the king. "A husband?" The queen was incredulous. "What on earth does she want a husband for? She's only 14. "I don't want a husband," put in Griselda. "I should think not," said the queen. "I've never heard such nonsense. You're surely not encouraging her, Arthur." "Well, what else is she going to do?" said the king defensively. "What do you want to do, Griselda?" asked her mother. "Well," said the princess, "I'd simply love to be an astronaut." "I've never heard of anything so ridiculous," said the king. "I think it's a wonderfully exciting idea," said the queen, "and you should certainly be allowed to try it. And now, Arthur," she continued, turning to the king, "I'd love something to eat. I'm so sick of slugs and snails." "Of course," cried the king. "I'm so sorry, my dear. I completely forgot. Let's all three of us have a special celebration meal right away. I'm so pleased to have you back again." "And so am I, Mama," sighed the princess, snuggling up to her mother. "It seems to me," said the enchanter to himself, "that this time I've made an entirely satisfactory job of things." And wrapping his cloak tightly round himself, he slipped out of the palace, off home to his own supper.
The Enchanted Toad by Judy Corbalis was read by Dawn French, and we'll have another classic tale for you in just a minute.
Wiggle your eyes and wiggle your nose. Wiggle your fingers and wiggle your toes.
Oh, look, Toes. There goes a horse and he looks in a bit of a hurry. So it must be time now for the next part of Black Beauty by Anna Sewell. After some unhappy times, Black Beauty was sold at a horse fair to a London cab driver, Jerry.
I never knew a better man than my new master. He was kind and so good-tempered and merry that very few people could pick a quarrel with him. His 12-year-old son Harry was clever at stable work, while his wife Polly and their 8-year-old daughter Dolly used to come in the morning to help with the cab, to brush and beat the cushions and rub the glass. Meanwhile, Jerry was giving us a cleaning in the yard, and Harry was rubbing the harness. There used to be a great deal of laughing and fun between them. They were always early in the morning, for Jerry couldn't bear loitering and wasting time. Nothing was so near making him angry as to find people wanting a cab horse to be driven hard to make up for their idleness. One day, two wild-looking young men came out of a tavern close by the stand and called Jerry.
"Here, cabbie, look sharp, we're rather late. Put on the steam, will you, and take us to Victoria in time for the 1 o'clock train? You'll have a shilling extra."
"I'll take you at the regular pace, gentlemen. Shillings don't pay for putting on the steam like that." Larry's cab was standing next to ours. He flung open the door.
"I'm your man, gentlemen. Take my cab. My horse will get you there all right."
Then, slashing his jaded horse, he set off as hard as he could. Jerry patted me on the back.
"No, Jack. A shilling wouldn't pay for that sort of thing. Would it, old boy?"
Although Jerry was firmly set against hard driving to please careless people, he wasn't against putting on the steam if he knew why.
One morning, as we were on the stand waiting for a fare, a young man carrying a heavy portmanteau trod on a piece of orange peel and fell down with great force. Jerry was the first to run and lift him up. He seemed stunned, and as they led him into a shop, he walked as if in great pain. Jerry came back to the stand, but in about 10 minutes one of the shopmen called him. "Can you take me to the Southeastern Railway?" said the young man. "This unlucky fall has made me late, I fear. But it is of great importance that I shouldn't lose the 12 o'clock train. I'd be most thankful if you could get me there in time, and I'd gladly pay you extra." "I'll do my very best," said Jerry. The next minute he was on the box. "Now then, Jack, my boy," he said, "spin along. We'll show them how we can get over the ground." If you want to get through London fast in the middle of the day, it wants a deal of practice. Jerry and I were used to it, and no one could beat us at getting through when we were set upon it. I was quick and bold, and could always trust my driver. Jerry was quick and patient at the same time, and could trust his horse. The streets were very full that day, but we got on pretty well as far as the bottom of Cheapside, where there was a block for 3 or 4 minutes. The young man put his head out. "I think I'd better get out and walk. I'll never get there if this goes on."
"I think we'll be there in time," said Jerry. "This block-up can't last much longer, and your luggage is very heavy for you to carry, sir."
Just then, the cart in front of us began to move on, and then we had a good turn. In and out we went, as fast as horse flesh could do it. By good luck, we had a good clear time on London Bridge, for there was a whole train of cabs and carriages all going our way at a quick trot, perhaps wanting to catch that very train. At any rate, as we whirled into the station, the great clock was pointing to 11:58. "Thank God we're in time," said the young man. "And thank you too, my friend, and your good horse. You've saved me more than money can ever pay for. Take this extra half-crown."
"No, sir, no. Thank you all the same. But don't stay now, sir. Here, porter, take this gentleman's luggage. Dover Line, 12 o'clock train."
And without waiting for another word, Jerry wheeled me around. On our return to the rank, there was a good deal of chafing at him for driving hard to the train for an extra fare against all his principles. And they wanted to know how much he'd pocketed.
"The gentleman offered me 0.5 crown extra, but I didn't take it. 'Twas quite pay enough for me to see how glad he was to catch that train."
"Well," said Larry, "you'll never be a rich man."
"Most likely not," said Jerry, "but I don't know that I'll be less happy for that."
On Sunday morning, Jerry was cleaning me in the yard when Polly stepped up to him, looking very full of something.
"What is it?" said Jerry.
"Well, my dear poor Dinah Brown has just had a letter brought to her to say that her mother is dangerously ill and that she must go directly if she wishes to see her alive. The place is more than 10 miles away from here, out in the country, and she wants to know if you would take her in your cab. She promises to pay you faithfully. She can get the money."
"It's not the money I'm thinking about, but of losing our Sunday. The horses are tired and so am I. That's where it pinches."
"It pinches all round," said Polly, "for it's only half Sunday without you. But you know we should do to other people as we'd like them to do to us. And I know very well what I should like if my mother was dying."
"Why, Polly, you're as good as the minister. And so, as I've had my Sunday morning sermon early today, you may go and tell Dinah that I'll be ready for her as the clock strikes 10. But first, just step round to Butcher Braden's with my compliments and ask him if he would lend me his light trap. I know he never uses it on the Sunday, and it'd make a wonderful difference to the horse."
Away she went, and soon returned, saying that he could have the trap, and welcome.
"All right," he said. "Now please put me up a bit of bread and cheese,
and I'll be back in the afternoon as soon as I can.
And away she went while he made his preparations. I was selected for the journey, and at 10 o'clock we started, in a light, high-wheeled gig, which ran so easily that after the four-wheeled cab, it seemed like nothing. It was a fine May day, and as soon as we were out of the town, the sweet air, the smell of the fresh grass, and the soft country roads were as pleasant as they used to be in the old times, and I soon began to feel quite fresh. Dinah's family lived in a small farmhouse up a green lane, close by a meadow with some fine shady trees. There were two cows feeding in it. A young man asked Jerry to bring his trap into the meadow, and he'd tie me up in the cowshed.
"There's nothing my horse would like so well," said Jerry, "as to have an hour or two in your beautiful meadow. It would be a rare treat for him."
"You're welcome," said the young man. "The best we have is at your service for your kindness to my sister." When my harness was taken off, I didn't know what to do first. Eat the grass, roll over on my back, lie down and rest, or have a gallop across the meadow out of sheer spirits at being free. In the end, I did all by turns. Jerry wandered down to a little brook where he picked flowers and hawthorn and tied them up with long sprays of ivy. Then he gave me a good feed of the oats which he'd brought with him. But the time seemed all too short. We came home gently, and Jerry's first words as we came into the yard were,
"Well, Polly, I haven't lost my Sunday after all, for the birds were singing hymns in every bush, and I joined in the service. And as for Jack, he was like a young colt."
When he handed Dolly the flowers, she jumped about for joy.
That turned into a good Sunday outing for everyone. Black Beauty was written by Anna Sewell and read for Little Toe by John Hasler. And you can catch the next part around the same time tomorrow. Well, we've come to the end of all our stories today, but before we go, we've time to squeeze in a little poem all about a shrimp called Cisco. Have you ever seen a shrimp when you visited the seaside? Well, listen to me reading Cisco the Shrimp by Chris White.
Cisco the Shrimp was going to the gym with his good friend Pedro the Prawn. They thought they would go and lift a few weights and try to build their fishy brawn. But when they got there, they stood out a mile and they got into one or two tussles. They weren't in the swim and they didn't blend in because the gym was packed full of mussels.
Sounds like a fishy tale to me. Cisco the Shrimp was written by Chris White. Well, that's the end of today's show. Did you all agree with the five reasons to listen to our Little Toe show? Well, we'll be back tomorrow with another great selection of stories. The gates will be open again at Wiggly Park, and our heroine Annie makes friends with a dog in It's Only Annie. Unfortunately, not so friendly is the large croc in Akimbo and the Crocodile Man. Find out what happens when he attacks their dinghy boat. And you can also find out what happens in The Emperor's New Clothes when he wears his new suit with some surprising results. Plus, of course, we'll be continuing the saga of Black Beauty. What's that, Toes? Oh, yes, of course we're going to have a wiggle. Take it away.
On DAB Digital Radio, this is BBC 7.